Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Early to rise, early in the sack. I thank God I'm a country boy. Well, a simple kind of life never did me no harm. Raising me a family and working on the farm. Days are all filled with an easy country charm. Thank God I'm a country boy. Well, I got me a fine wife, I got me old fiddle. When the sun's coming up, I got cakes on the griddle. Life ain't nothing but a funny, funny riddle. Thank God I'm a country boy.
Today on Route 51, the people who live off the land in Wisconsin and give us the land's bounty so that we too can live. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guest is Ed Janis, a former dairy farmer, a radio journalist, an oral historian, and the author of a provocative book called Creating Dairyland, subtitled How Caring for Cows Saved Our Soil, Created Our Landscape, Brought Prosperity to Our State, and Still Shapes Our Way of Life in Wisconsin. Janis's beautifully written and researched book makes the point that the development of dairy farming in Wisconsin was, in fact, the thing that created the progressive tradition in our state, in our politics, in our culture, and in our social life. We'll be exploring those ideas over the next hour, and we'll be hearing from dairy farmers and cheesemakers in their own words as they tell us why they have stayed with the grueling, difficult life of the family farm, and why they would have it no other way. As always, we want you to join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. Again, that's 1-800-780-9742. Ed, welcome to Route 51.
Well, thanks, Glenn. What's your introduction there? I couldn't have written it better myself. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, because you're a good writer, so that's a compliment.
Thank you.
Tell us about your background. You grew up in Washington, D.C. How did you end up as a Wisconsin dairy farmer?
Oh, boy. Do you want the short story?
Short story.
Okay, the short version. So I went to school in Chicago and was involved in a group of people who ultimately went up to Madison and opened the Ovens of Brittany. I don't know if you remember the Ovens of Brittany. It was one of the first, how should we say, new wave local vore restaurants. This is in the early 1970s. So we were kind of a commune, and we also owned a farm. And I got the chance to go out to the farm. I had no experience of the farm. And, of course, the first day, you know, there's all the manure and the odor and everything. And it was at that point I realized that I could get clean if I washed my boots off. So I then embraced the farm and realized that it was, you know, from then on, it was just a wonderful experience.
Tell us about this ongoing oral history project that you're involved in.
Well, I got to go back a little bit. So about 5 or 6 years ago, I got a job to do some audio programs, and you're going to play some excerpts from them.
Right.
Some with current, contemporary dairy farmers and cheesemakers. And that, of course, got me thinking. So I didn't understand enough after I talked to them. They had very interesting things to say, but I knew there had to be more. And I realized it was history that was the more, that we don't really see what's happened in the past, and that would make the book much richer. I talk about the deeper soil, and that's the history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went out and I interviewed all sorts of people. I read all sorts of really interesting old books that no one ever touches, full of dust and everything, and realized that these old people had something really interesting to say, stuff that if I didn't capture it or if somebody didn't capture it, would be lost. Very interesting insights that you can read about, but it means so much more if you get to talk to them. And every single one of these older people had something to add to my knowledge.
You were conducting interviews with farmers at Farm Progress Days in Marathon County just a few weeks ago. Were there any common threads to their stories?
You know, it's interesting. We asked, one of the questions we asked everybody, because these were generally older farmers, we said, well, gee, you know, if you took your grandfather here, and you showed them around this technology, this incredible machinery and all sorts of scientific things, what do you think the old man would say? And we got a lot of different answers, but mostly they just shake their head and say, no one would believe it. My grandfather wouldn't believe it. And then we follow up and say, well, do you think it's a good thing, all this technology? And this is where it gets interesting, because they all say it's good. You know, because every farmer you ever talk to talks about how they get bad knees or bad hips and that sort of thing. It used to hurt to be a farmer. So they don't you know, they're not romantic about that. But some of them are very wistful, I'd say, about the old days when it was a smaller, more intimate setting, when the farmer and the boys and the bachelor brother or somebody was all you needed.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's become, of course, much more business, much more managerial. So there is this kind of wistfulness about the good old days.
Well, the very idea of farm progress days implies progress. You argue that Wisconsin's history of dairy farming is tied to our progressive traditions. How is that?
Well, let me just make my statement first, that I believe that the Wisconsin idea, we've all heard of that, that's this progressive era idea of what the university should be doing, what the state should be doing, found its most successful activity. It was most successful in dairy farming. So what you had was around 1860, Wisconsin was in terrible, terrible shape. The people, the early pioneers had come and they had founded farms, and then they really ruined the land. I mean, we think of our farmers today as being very responsible, but boy, oh boy, they, wheat farmers in those days, and they had no sense of the future. They used to talk about wheat mining. It was a form of exploitation. And so Wisconsin was in terrible shape, and part of the terrible shape was in the sort of moral and economic core of our farmers.
You wrote in your book that wheat made men crazy.
That's right. Wheat made men crazy. And there were, I call them preachers, there were prophets like W.D. Horde and many others who got on their pulpits, and this happened in churches all over the state, and just reamed out farmers for their irresponsible behavior. And so the progressive era was this era in which we believed we could make everything new again, and make everything new, that America repudiated this sort of European past, and that science, education, and good free markets would change everything for farmers, and it would change everything and make farmers better people. And that's what they were trying to do.
That whole idea seemed to grow out of Thomas Jefferson's concept of the yeoman farmer,
right,
the land-based citizen who'd create a stable, agricultural-oriented democracy.
Well, you know, so that's right. Jefferson was a believer in the agrarian America. But the agrarian America was shifting. People were moving to the city. So this sort of Jeffersonian idea was losing steam. And especially as farmers became interested in money. So the Jeffersonian farmer, you know, he needed money, of course, but he was self-sufficient, a man on his own. He owned the land. He fought
right
for it, you know. But now these farmers come to Wisconsin, and they're kind of not being responsible. So they wanted to change humanity. And that's really the program of progressives, that you can change the nature of mankind and his conditions through reason and science.
And that was the core of the entire idea of the Enlightenment, which
exactly,
you know, those were the thoughts
that's right.
Were the groundwork for the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the entire American Revolution.
Yeah, I mean, you could say, and I do, that dairying in some wonderful way is one of the best expressions of that American spirit, that repudiation of the old ways of doing things from Europe.
And there is something about being a family farmer, this mm-hmm. sense of independence, this sense of caring for the land, caring for your cows, that gets into your blood. I want to play right now one of the oral history segments that you put together.
Great.
It's a group of farmers, the Myers,
mm-hmm.
Dwight, Shelley, and Kathy, and 72-year-old Dick Meyer, fourth-generation farmers near Slinger.
My name is Dwight Meyer.
Shelley Meyer.
I'm Cassie Meyer.
We farm here by Slinger. My wife and three kids have our family farm, which has been in our family for four generations.
98% of the farms in Wisconsin are family owned and run. That is important. It's a model that's been very successful for many generations.
I'm Dick Meyer. I'm 72 years old now. I grew up right next door here, a quarter mile away, born in the house over there. But Dad just was born just up the road from the place he and Mom started out on, where the Myers settled in the about 1848-49. Our oldest three kids went on to school. They all married farmers or farmers' daughters, and they're still farming.
And we had a cow that was getting ready to deliver a calf. And I remember Grandma saying to me, Shelley, out of all my years and all the things that I've witnessed, still, I think the neatest thing is the first time a calf finds its feet. And it's what does make you get out of bed in the morning. Regardless of the milk price being high or it being low, it is that miracle, that rebirth. And it's those simple things that make all the other things just kind of fade.
People tell you it's a business, you know, but it is, it's more than a business. It's a way of life, and you have to like cattle.
We're both skilled and have something special when it comes to working with cattle. That's what brought my husband and I together. And in our worst of times, our most difficult economic times, as we've bought the farm and we've seen a lot of volatility, I've looked at my husband and said, you know, we both have degrees from the university, so it's not like we have to do this. We chose this career. And I'll say, what do you want to do? You don't look happy. What do you want to do? And he goes, there's nothing I want to do other than farm. So it was do what we wanted, that we like to do, figure out a way financially to make it work, and thirdly, do what you do best. We're really good with cows.
Ike's had a pretty good eye. He's a good cow man. He's got good cow sense.
That has been a skill from great-grandpa Meyer to grandpa Meyer, from father to son, that gets passed. That is what, in a lot of ways, has made the Wisconsin dairy industry so special.
The Myers, fourth-generation farmers. Their farm is located near Slinger, and we have with us today the gentleman who gathered that sound and who interviewed those farmers and many other farmers, and has, a philosophical treatise called Creating Dairyland, Ed Janis. Ed, what was your overall impression of the Myers?
Aren't they wonderful? I mean, a couple things strike me. It was because of the Myers that I understood something that I hadn't understood before, many, many things, but one of which is, in a kind of a way, in a sort of Darwinian way, cows selected humans. So in the early, thank you, in the early days of dairying, when it was not a popular thing to do. By the way, there were riots in small towns around Wisconsin when it was proposed that men, for heaven's sakes, become dairy farmers, because it was women's work. It was belittling. So there's been this incredible transformation of guys who were reluctant farmers to becoming people that genuinely love cows. And it is that love of cows, I'm telling you, that motivates almost every dairy farmer I've ever met. So cows selected us, and it's a very specialized world they live in. So the Myers, especially Ike Meyer, taught me that. And the other thing that Shelley taught me is this idea of miracles. So she talks about the price of milk, and it's usually volatile, and people are always pulling their hair out about the price of milk. But it's that little calf. You go to a farm today, and you cannot help but being drawn to those calves. And they built a dairy industry. That is, Wisconsin built a dairy industry on the love of a calf, love of calves. Every farm kid shows calves, take care of them, feed them. That's how this love affair begins.
Ed Janis, an oral historian, radio journalist, and the author of Creating Dairyland. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, working to build the local economy and strengthen the community by making local business everybody's business. Learn more about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51. Our guest, Ed Janis, the author of Creating Dairyland. Ed, you're talking about the spiritual aspect of dairy farming.
Right. Yeah.
And that in the latter part of the 1800s, there were actual preachers and people who were tied in politically with figures like Abraham Lincoln,
yeah,
who developed the concept of a church of the cow.
Right.
Did that really happen?
Yeah. I mean, they talked about themselves quite often as missionaries. And these were, if you'll forgive the expression, Yankee scolds. Many of the leaders of the dairy industry were from New York and ultimately from New England. So they were sort of these Puritan-type Yankee preachers. W.D. Hoard, who later became the cow governor of Wisconsin, was one such guy. And they were as much biblical prophets as they were agriculturalists. They weren't really agriculturalists. They were prophetic. And they loved scolding farmers. And one of the things that they really were trying to get farmers to do, I mentioned earlier, is change who they are, become different kinds of people. And one of the things they proposed, quite consciously, was loving cows as a way of centering their lives on other beings and being responsible and caring. Can I read a little something?
You betcha.
Do you have a minute?
Yeah.
So this is from Hoard's Dairyman, which is the sort of magazine of progressive dairying for the last 120 years. The letter to the editor from 1912. And the writer goes on, he says, I like the way you talked about sentiment in dairy work. You said that to succeed, one must be in love with the cow. I wanted to get up then and tell the audience that there was at least one young dairyman on the road to success. Just before the morning session of the convention, I saw a boy, just a chubby little fellow of 10 or 12 years, standing by the head of a little Jersey heifer. The little fellow placed one arm around the heifer's neck, placed his mouth to her ear as if to whisper to her, and then pressed his lips to the eye of the little beauty. I imagine, he said to her, do your best, Jersey love. Get a blue ribbon if you can. But if you get none, I will love you just as well as ever. This boy will surely be a successful dairyman. That sums it up.
Now, there's a personal love of animals. There's also a professional love. I want to play another one of your oral history clips. This is a group of farmers, the Crave Brothers, who have managed to balance the two concepts.
Well, when we were younger, we just assumed we'd be farming on our home farm. But when I was a sophomore in high school, my dad discontinued farming. At the time, he was one of 60,000 dairy farmers in Wisconsin. And he sold his cows in 1974.
I remember him saying that the price of milk dropped dramatically. He had enough. He said, how can I take care of my family and run a farm when the price of milk goes up and down, and now it just went down dramatically again? It's too hard on me. It's too difficult to make a living that way.
He was a person who always said, there's got to be a better way to do this task or that task. Or you know, we have to be able to make feed better because of this or that.
He was a progressive farmer for his time. He's 79 now, and he says, this is what I always wanted, to have a modern farm and be able to make things work in a more mechanized way.
And he's pleased that we're able to do that, and also says, why shouldn't we be able to in agriculture? Every other industry does it.
We were married in 1982, and there were some rough years for agriculture at that time. Thankfully, I was working in Madison. George is a cowman, and he just always wanted to milk cows and take good care of them. And so he and his brothers did that. They split the duties and raised all their own feed and milked their cows and did a really good job. It was simpler then in terms of we were just happy to milk a small number of cows and do a good job at that. Get good production, take good care of the animals, work with a cooperative to get a good milk price.
Sometimes I wish I had 50 cows and my wife and I could just go out there and take care of those 50 or whatever. I mean, you really knew your cattle a little bit better. It's kind of like, do you want your doctor to know you as a friend or as a professional? So now we know our cattle as a professional.
I used to just love cows, and I love milking them and walking amongst them and selecting the matings, and I still love that. But it's progressed for me to more of a professional, strategic thinking. In 1974, the average cow in Wisconsin produced around 12,000 pounds of milk. My dad's cows probably produced around 13,000 or 14,000 pounds of milk, and now our cows produce 30,000 pounds of milk. You wouldn't have dreamt of this type of production in 1974. everything changes over a couple of generations of cows, and almost a generation of farmers is incredible. Unfortunately, everything progresses except it seems like the price of milk.
The Crave brothers, farmers who, well, Dad sold the family farm in the 70s, but the four of them have managed to use modern technology to stay in the business. And the quote that I really love there is, do you want your family doctor to be your friend or a professional?
It's wonderful. These guys are very, very bright. And one of them mentioned something, I think this is sort of the hallmark of progressive dairying. He said, Dad always looked for a better way. And that's what these guys are doing. I want to add something about the Crave brothers. They have a manure digester. And this is one of the advantages of having a large farm. They have about 1,000 cows. With a large farm like the Crave brothers, they can take the manure and create electricity, cut down on the odors that their neighbors smell that a small farm can't do. And so one of the lessons of the Crave brothers is you really do have to keep moving because it's a very competitive world out there and you need to become more and more efficient.
Large farms, they call them factory farms, are quite controversial in Wisconsin.
Sure.
But Ed Janis, you're not a nostalgia freak when it comes down to this stuff.
I do not belong to the nostalgia party. As I like to say, as I say in the book, time waits for no red barn. Things move on. What was the perfect dairy farm? Was it 5 cows? Was it 10 cows? Was it 15 cows? It keeps getting larger. Here's an example. In 1920, it would have cost you 65 cents for a gallon of milk at the store. Today's dollars, that's $7.40. That it only costs $2.80 today is a testament to people like the Crave brothers, who became more and more efficient at what they did.
But as they say, that price of milk, they live and die by that.
They do. See, what happened around 1910 or so is that milk went from being a specialty food to a commodity. And when you're a commodity, you've got all this volatility in the price. You can never corral the price.
Hold that thought. I want to come back to the price of milk and the fact that family farmers stay with the farm even though they have to struggle to make it work. We've got Ed Janis with us. We'll have more after this news.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at umr.com.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me.
Today on Route 51, the people who live off the land in Wisconsin and give us the land's bounty so that we too can live. Our guest is Ed Janis, a former dairy farmer, a radio journalist, an oral historian, and the author of a book called Creating Dairyland, in which he argues that caring for cows, dairy farming, has been really an important part of Wisconsin's progressive tradition, if not the defining part of it. Ed Janis, we were discussing factory farms before we left, and many people would say that's not progressive.
Well, I've got a number of things to say about that. First of all, in the 1900s and 1920s, the idea of the farm as factory, that was the way they talked about it, was a very positive thing. They wanted to get farmers who were kind of often sort of slipshod operators to think of their farm as an entire process. So not just do it the way Dad did it, but think about it as a business. And how do you make money here and how do you make money here? How do you improve this? How do you improve that? And in some way, they were promoting this concept of sustainability. So when I hear people criticizing factory farms, I want to remind them that this is a dairy industry. and that we need to produce milk efficiently, or if we don't produce milk efficiently, there will be no farms in Wisconsin because people in New Zealand can do it cheaper than we can, or people in California can. So we need to keep up with, you know, as an industry.
I attended a public hearing on a proposed factory farm in Adams County, and there were 450 people in that room by my count in a rural area without much population, and these people were all, you know, mad. I mean, just angry about the thought of the additional traffic, the smell. They were worried about groundwater contamination. They were worried about phosphorus and manure leaking into their pristine lakes and trout streams.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can't answer in any one particular case. Is this a good operator? Is this large? And I don't want to call it a factory farm. Is this large farm? Is he a good operator? Often, like the Cray brothers, they can afford to do things that the small farms can't. Now, you talk about phosphorus and manure. But, you know, in 1945, we had nearly double the amount of cows. And double the amount of cows meant double the amount of manure. Oh, it was very idyllic. The cows, you know, were grazing in the hillside there and pooping in the streams and dropping their manure any old place. It wasn't that good for the soil. So we think, oh, well, you've got all these cows together, it's bad. But really, you had that many cows, it would just spread out. And I, for one, don't quite understand the problem with bringing them all together. Again, the DNR needs to be, you know, strong and regulate this thing properly. But some of these old farmers, they'd let their manure stand around all winter and it would leach into the soil. It wasn't, they weren't that good at it.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation with Ed Janis. Do you think that dairy farming and farming in general was a key to Wisconsin's progressive political tradition, to who we are today, our culture, our way of getting along with people? Do you think that so-called factory farms can be a part of that progressive tradition and aren't necessarily bad? 1-800-780-9742. We have wide open phone lines right now. And Ed, I want you to get a plug in. You're going to be at Yonke Books after this?
That's right. At 6:30, I'm going to talk a little bit about just the sort of things we've been talking about here, sign copies of the book for anybody that wants it.
That's Yonke Books in downtown Wausau.
Third Avenue, is it?
Third Street.
Third Street, yeah. Okay.
Avenues are on the west, streets are on the east. You got to keep that straight.
Where's Wrigley Field from here?
We don't have Wrigley Field. Yeah. We do have Athletic Park, okay, which is our own version of it. Let's play another one of your oral history segments. And am I pronouncing this right? The Trutmans?
Trutmans.
Who
down by New Glarus,
who have gone back to the traditional method of grass-fed cows or rotational grazing. And you write on the website that carries all of this, which is, incidentally, what, eatwisconsincheese.com?
I'm not sure who's got it now. Sorry. It's on the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board's, one of their websites.
Let's see, okay. I wrote this down. Okay. It is. It's eatwisconsincheese.com. All right, the Trutmans, and you describe their approach to farming as forward, which is, of course, the Wisconsin slogan, forward to yesterday.
When I got out of college and started farming with my father, we realized very quickly we needed to make some changes in order to support two families. My father and I were working together, and we wanted to continue that because we saw that as being beneficial to both of us if we could find a way to keep this farm economically viable for our family. And fortunately for us, rotational grazing was becoming popular again. Well, I shouldn't even say again. It was becoming popular for the first time in Wisconsin because grazing had been done in the past. This was new. At first, he didn't want to go back to Grandpa's way of farming, but we argued that it wasn't Grandpa's way of farming. This was the new twist. He's shaken his head about it a lot over the years, but has become a very big fan of the way that we farm. Over the last few years, I started thinking more and more that we're producing such a good product here that I hated to put it on the truck and have it blended in with everybody else's conventional milk.
He'd been talking about pulling milk out of the bulk tank for us to drink, and he'd been reading more and more about the benefits to having the animals on the grass and what that would translate into leaving behind in their milk as far as the good fats and nutrients that we need.
I don't mean to be pious about that, but I thought that our milk really had something extra, and I wanted to find a way to capture that. But we had no idea how to go about it. When this opportunity came up with other two farms to form a co-op and start making our own cheese. The first few days that we were making the cheese and walk into the factory, which is now partly our factory, which is really neat, and Bruce is there, and to see the look on his face was just precious. And then to watch our cheese develop and age, and the color getting deeper, and it's just really neat.
Our children are in elementary school, and you know, you give teacher gifts for holidays and so forth, and I always like to give cheese, but I never really knew that, well, this is our milk maybe, but it might have been in a different vat that day. And so now I know that this is our milk, this is our cheese.
I know that this is our milk, this is our cheese.
They're wonderful people. I love those people. You know, we talked about milk being a commodity. A lot of young farmers today, they want to stand out. Farmers always have a difficult time standing out from the crowd. The milk gets blended, as he said, with milk from hundreds of other farms. And so there is this movement towards artisanal cheese or something that you can charge more for, because farmers are always trying to transcend commodity prices.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to get something that they can see as their own. It's not this huge vat of milk. And that Trutmans are right at the beginning. Lots of these artisanal cheese makers now. It's an open question whether they'll succeed, many of them. But they're making some cheeses that no one's ever believed you could make in Wisconsin.
And grass-fed cows?
Yeah.
Does their milk taste different?
They claim it does. Yeah, there's some controversy about this, and people like to not make too many claims. Grass-fed beef, grass-fed milk is considered healthier by some. I don't know what the science actually is, but it does have a deeper color.
And for people looking for something different,
anytime
you can find niche marketing for your
exactly.
product, it's going to help you.
That's exactly. And if people feel that it tastes better or it looks different, that's a good thing to have. Again, trying to transcend commodities.
Let's go to the phones. We have a call from Sandy in Mosinee. Is this Sandy Seiler?
Yes, it is.
Sandy has been a guest on this program before when we've been talking about dairy issues. Sandy, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm listening to the interview and really enjoying it, and just called to say that I really agree with a lot of Ed's statements. I think he's made some really insightful comments on why the sizes of some Wisconsin dairy farms have changed over the years, why that's a good thing for Wisconsin dairy. You know, I think that it really comes down to a management choice. There's no such thing as a good size. We have right. beautiful grazing operations in the state, the traditional red barns, and the progressive larger freestall operations. And that's the beauty of Wisconsin dairy is the diversity. It makes us a very rich, and the choices are there for farm families to pick a style of farming that suits their resources and their personal preference.
That's an excellent point, Sandy. This is Ed. Excellent mm-hmm. point. I wish I had said it myself. Thank you.
Sandy, do you agree with Ed's characterization of dairy farming and the culture of cows as being really one of the things that led to the creation of Wisconsin's progressive political tradition?
You know, until I've heard Ed state that, I'd never really thought about it in those terms before, but I think he makes a good point. The type of people that populated this state and decided to make dairy their lifestyle, I think there is a certain mindset and an attitude there. That, again, I hadn't thought of it that way before, but I would tend to agree. I think Ed's got a good point there.
I want to take a little issue with the way Glenn characterizes. I don't argue necessarily, Sandy, that it's a political thing, but it's a way of sort of a mental approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's more important. It has its, you know, it sometimes is political, it's sometimes social, it's sometimes economic. But this idea that we're building for the future and not relying on the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that farmers have every right to be very well educated. They don't have to be the poor cousins of city people. I think that was the genius of Daring in Wisconsin.
Well, you know, and again, that's a good way to characterize it too, Ed, because in today's world, in order to be successful, and it doesn't matter the size or the management style, the industry is changing and evolving so quickly that for a dairy farmer to be successful in the future, it's just critical that the lifelong learning is a part of that process.
Right, and you know the wonderful thing, Sandy, I think, is that dairying kind of introduced that to rural Wisconsin. The idea that the university existed to help farmers,
mm-hmm.
not to teach about Immanuel Kant or Aristotle, but to help farmers become more prosperous. And if farmers were more prosperous, they could be the equals of anyone in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Sandy, thanks so mm-hmm. much for the phone call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks,
bye.
Sandy. Bye-bye.
Well, I think the university can teach Immanuel Kant and help out the dairy farmers
but, you know,
at the same
time. It was a big controversy. They tried to keep the ag school away from Madison.
Well, E.L. Luther was the state's right. first extension
right.
agent. That was back in 1912.
Is that right?
And the whole idea was bringing the science of the university to the farmer.
Right.
And, you know, we've got a long tradition of that here at Wisconsin Public Radio. We are part of the UW Extension
exactly.
tradition. And that's
right.
that's what Wisconsin Public Radio was initially. It was primarily an agricultural service, bringing the university to people who were living in rural areas, letting them know what the weather was like and other things that they needed for their daily survival.
Right. I hadn't realized that, of course.
You're listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guest, Ed Janis, he's got a fascinating book out called Creating Dairyland. We're listening to some of his oral history segments, and we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation.
Support for WPR comes from Northwind Renewable Energy in Stevens Point, partnering with agricultural and commercial industries to invest in central Wisconsin's renewable energy future. More about the benefits of solar for business at northwindre.com.
We have Ed Janis with us. He's talking about his book, Creating Dairyland. Again, he's going to be signing books at Yankee Books in downtown Wausau and talking about the concepts in his book at 6:30 this evening, right after this program. And we are playing oral history segments, which you can find on the website. Here we go.
In our own voices.
Yeah, in our own voices.
I think that's the headline on it.
Yeah, but you can also find it on eatwisconsincheese.com. And speaking of eating cheese, let's listen right now to a couple of cheesemakers, master cheesemakers in Greene County, Jeff Weidman and Bruce Workman.
I had an old guy that I worked for, and he started out in a little cheddar plant up by Lafarge. I always remembered the little saying he had. He says, I worked the first month and I got my first paycheck, and he says, I bought a new pair of shoes. And he says, I was so proud of those shoes, I wore them to work the next day, and I walked in and the cheesemaker he was working for says, I see you got a new pair of shoes. He says, yep, bought them with my own money. He says, I want to tell you something, young man. You get milk on those shoes and you're never going to get it off. Cheesemaking isn't a job, it's a way of life.
At every intersection there were cheese factories. Every little farm around the corner would bring their milk to the one co-op.
And they'd bring the milk in twice a day. He'd make cheese in the morning and then again at night. I think the whole key at that time was this milk was all being received in cans. And a cheesemaker's nose is very important. When he knocked the lid off that can every morning, and that first sniff of that milk is extremely important, you know. It had to pass his nose first. He wouldn't take it in because you can't make good cheese out of bad milk.
At that time, we sold to one person in Monroe. The truck came, picked it up. We took it down.
You had to satisfy that buyer, and that was the last you knew about your cheese.
It's a very large challenge to make cheese. There's so many variables and so many things that can happen.
There are times of the year when the milk changes a lot, and you have to be able to feel that. You have to be able to tell in the curd, and all your senses come into play. The sight, the smell, sound somewhat, a taste. When I got into this business and I first took over Maple Leaf, all I really wanted was to have my farmer say he was a good cheesemaker, because that was as good as it got. You know, the farmer tell another farmer, you know, so-and-so on that factory over there, he's a darn good cheesemaker. Well, we've turned from not only cheesemakers into cheese marketers. And the biggest challenge is about marketing our own cheese is returning as much profit back to our farmers as we can. That's become a lot of competition amongst the cheese plants.
Without the farmers, we don't have a job.
That's Jeff Weidman and Bruce Workman, Greene County Master Cheesemakers. And you talk about the Crossroads cheese tradition. Explain that.
Yeah. Well, so the cheese industry is what created the dairy industry. Before these cheese plants, before capitalists invested in professional, highly technological cheese plants, there was nothing to do. You couldn't sell the milk. Where were you going to sell it? They sold it as butter in the county store, the neighborhood store. So these cheese plants were the linchpin in Wisconsin. But early on, no one believed you could make good cheese in Wisconsin. And so, of course, you had to have the plants close to the farms. Once they realized you could actually make money selling cheese, the farmers said, well, I'm going to put some more cows in. And it sort of mushroomed from there. So those cheese factories are really the sort of the thing that hold it all together.
And they mentioned the co-op. Co-ops are very important.
Yeah. Well, so Wisconsin is known for its milk marketing co-ops. In 1940s or 50s, 70% or something of the milk was sold through co-ops. And that's part of not the progressive tradition, but the populist tradition in Wisconsin. So you got two kinds of farmers. You got progressive farmers, and you kind of got these populist farmers as well. So there's a...
There can be a little bit of an overlay.
There are, of course. Yes, I don't want to make it too obvious.
And one of the things that you write about, and rapidly running out of time here, but dairy farming also changed the role of the woman on the farm, too. You had silos that were built, and suddenly mm-hmm. you could feed the cows, and they could produce milk 12 months out of the year instead of just 6 or 7 months, so mm-hmm. it became a more reliable, stable environment.
That's right.
And women really benefited in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think it was one of the first acts in the women's liberation movement. Because in the old days, if you had a couple cows, the women made the butter, they made the cheese, and it was a huge commitment during the summer to do this work. With the advent of cheese factories and professional cheesemakers, the women were relieved of this. And part of the progressive program was to let women get off the work from the farm and make a home, make a family, domesticate the husband, educate the children, refine all of them. And that was very successful because they wanted farmers to stay on the land. And the way to make them stay on the land is to make them happy at home.
Ed Janis, what do you see the future of dairy farming to be in Wisconsin?
From all I know, and this is not my expertise, it looks very good because we've got this rain, we've got this wonderful grass, we've got this incredible infrastructure where we really do know how to do this. And some of these places that specialized in just dairying, like California, they're hurting. So I think it looks good for us.
Ed, thanks so much. It's been a fascinating hour. And again, if you'd like to meet Ed in person, he'll be signing books at Yaki Books, downtown Wausau, in just a half hour. I want to thank today's guest, Ed Janis, the author of Creating Dairyland. You can find out more about Ed's work and hear more of his oral history reports on the website eatwisconsincheese.com. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Special music today by Woody Guthrie, John Denver, and Louis Jordan. Thanks as always to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. We can be heard every Thursday at 5 p.m. on the Ideas Network stations WLBL 91.9 FM Wausau, 930 AM Auburndale Stevens Point, WHBM 90.3 FM Park Falls, WHAA 89.1 FM Adams Wisconsin Rapids, and WHRM 90.9 FM High Definition Channel 3. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Until next week, we're heading out of town.
Cluck, cluck, said the little red hen, let's move in the barnyard. Bad, bad, said the sheep from another pole. Moo, moo, said the cow, let the butter roll. Cluck, 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 said the little red hen, let's move in the barnyard. Yes, the barnyard was jumping, everybody having their fling. Even old MacDonald had to do a little corny swing. Bow wow, said the dog in the circus, top me meow, said the cat, now please don't stop. Cluck, 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 said the little red hen, let's boogie in the barnyard.